The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelbarth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Without a trace, the lack of solid evidence frustrates searches for a missing jetliner, infuriates loved ones on the ground, and has TV news in speculation mode 24/7.
Capital offensives, for and against Obamacare, more overtime pay, less deportation, and a stronger U.S. role in the Ukraine crisis, to name just a few.
Francis Year One, what the new pope has accomplished by his first anniversary at the Vatican, how the church has reacted, and where both are heading.
Theater on Air, how a former actress gets big stars for small plays meant, like our show, for ears only on radio and the internet.
The grandson also rises. Daniel Jobim is here to play and sing the Brazilian hits of Antonio Carlos Jobim, as well as American music masters.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of March 16th and St. Patrick's Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelbarth with a quote from the news. They're setting fire to the future of the internet. You guys are all the firefighters. We need you to help us fix this. That was fugitive NSA leaker Edward Snowden in a phone call to the South by Southwest Music and Technology Conference. Later in the week, the spirit of the 30-year-old festival was shattered when a driver evading arrest there slammed his car into a crowd, killing two and injuring at least 23. Now this.
We, in an investigation led by the Malaysian government, an investigation that involves many nations with many assets, are following leads where we find them. And it's my understanding that based on some new information that's not necessarily conclusive, but new information, an additional search area may be opened in the Indian Ocean.
So little information for so long about a missing Malaysian Air jetliner with 239 aboard had relatives on the ground in Beijing hurling water bottles at officials and shouting, "Tell us the truth." And after days of groundless speculation by air safety and accident experts, new data confirmed by White House Press Secretary Jay Carney suggested no accident at all, or at least some degree of human manipulation that cut off much of the plane's automatic communication and took it far, far off course, perhaps even to a secret landing, since no evidence of crash debris or black box beacons had turned up on either land or sea, at least not as we record.
It was, some cable news commentators agreed, something out of today's growing library of terror and espionage fiction. And on the theory that perhaps a novelist is better qualified than most to speculate on the plot and motives that may be involved, for Your Ears Only, we have one on the line. But Andrew Harp is also a pilot, plane owner, and retired Marine colonel who served at the Pentagon and around the world. And his latest book, Retribution, involves both a terrorist air attack and a jihadi base in Aceh, Indonesia, just across the Malacca Straits from Malaysia. Colonel Harp, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You were saying by midweek that this might be a hijacking gone out of control. What reports most made you think that?
Well, particularly as a pilot, when a transponder goes off, that's just incredibly unusual. In North America, as you taxi out, air traffic control gives you a four-digit number. You squawk that number, and you are tracked through your destination with that number. For it to go off is just a very, very big red flag.
A satellite reading suggests the plane flew for 6 hours or more after breaking off communications, with some course changes, and 7 hours of fuel. So landing in a far-off area with sufficient runways can't be dismissed. Do you suspect such a landing or simply a fatal crash somewhere not initially searched?
I think, tragically, I suspect a crash for a couple of reasons. One, of course, seems to be a very intentional act that somebody got in that cabin. Actually, in my book, Retribution, the plot is that a general aviation airplane, water plane, the transponder is taken out of it, and it flies very low on the deck to get to its destination. But in this particular case, you're talking about the transponder going out, and then you're talking about, as accurate as we know from the news reports, variance of altitude, drastic variance of altitude, and then also a specific change in direction towards the west, which is towards Aceh province. And Aceh province, on the northernmost province on Sumatra, the island of Sumatra, has been a haven for terrorist cell developments since the Bali explosion and bombing back in the early 2000s.
All the misinformation and disinformation was blamed mostly on Malaysian inexperience with such a massive search effort. But I begin to wonder if it wasn't on orders from Washington to keep any hijackers, if they survived, from knowing that SEAL Team 6 might be hunting for them. Too far-fetched even for fiction?
That's pretty far-fetched. Pretty far-fetched. Although I will say this, that the intensity and interest of this part of the world is increased enough that the Marine Corps has moved units to Darwin, Australia, which is on that northern coast of Australia. So Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines are a place that are being watched. And Al-Qaeda has been fairly active in each of those places by either Al-Qaeda or other names, such as JL or JAT.
What do you see as the likeliest target if the Malaysia Air episode is hijacking? Malaysia, with a 65% Muslim population, China, which had most of the passengers and an angry Muslim minority, international society at large, or simply ransom?
Well, one strategist's theory is that a terrorist cell cannot, in those countries, in those worlds, write a letter to the editor and get on the front page. And there's one strategist that says more extreme acts force them to the front page so that they can get the attention that they want. So if you did something extreme like this, you are going to get the world's attention, which is, of course, being proven by the point.
Whatever the truth and final resting place of the missing plane, some factors in the case are clearly cause for concern, beginning with the failure of Malaysia Air to check passenger documents against an international data bank of stolen passports. Do you think there should be stiffer regulations or punishments focused on such failures?
Certainly there should be sensitivity to this. And we constantly are learning the fact that our world has changed, that air travel has shrunk our world considerably. We know that there are some entry points that are more dangerous than other entry points. The shoe bomber on Delta several years ago got on the airplane in, I believe, in Africa. So there are some entry points that there needs to be more sensitivity to.
As a pilot and plane owner yourself, do you think there should be requirements for better technology to make civilian aircraft easier to keep track of, maybe with more use of satellites, at least less easy ways to turn off those transponders and other automatic communicating equipment?
Well, from a general aviation standpoint, general aviation is really actually surprisingly a pretty small community. So in general aviation, people generally know who's on the airfield, who's taking off, what's happening. In the general public information, particularly in North America, if they are looking at their radar scopes, and they are for certain, then the transponders provide a lot of information. All the Boeing information that's uploaded, it provides an incredible amount of information. I think the problem in this case is this is in a fairly dark spot of the world, in the sense that that was some lonesome water that they were flying over. The other interesting thing real quickly is that this all happened after they gained altitude and then climbed to their cruise altitude. That to me would be another red flag because that's probably when you would have someone make an effort.
But do you think that it's too easy for pilots to turn off those transponders? Should there be requirements that these things do keep going, that they can't easily be turned off with a switch at the cockpit or even digging in into the plane's fuselage?
That's a good question, but in North America, if you turn off your transponder, that is just as much a red flag as if it were in a remote location. Air traffic control will call you quickly, and you'll probably have somebody in your rear view mirror if you're a 777 at altitude and you turn your transponder off in, like I say, in North America or most travel lanes.
Thank you. Retired Marine Colonel Andrew Harp is also a Pentagon veteran, a private pilot and plane owner, and author of the new novel Retribution. You can check it out at andersonharp.net.
Quote from the news, "We deserve better. It's time for a change." That was Canadian Olivia Chow, a left-leaning former parliament member, opening her campaign to replace controversial Toronto Mayor Rob Ford.
Next, capital offenses on health care, deportation, the Ukraine. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. An attempt by the Justice Department to pull the wool over the public's eyes. That was Iowa's Republican Senator Charles Grassley after an inspector general determined that the Justice Department had given mortgage fraud by financial institutions the lowest priority on its agenda, despite White House promises to the contrary. Also last week, William Dudley, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, reiterated complaints about, quote, ethical and cultural failures at many large financial institutions that earlier sent chills through Wall Street. Now this.
Okay, let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work.
I don't think it helps the economy at all. No, what it does is to raise the cost for employers significantly. And when you do that, you get fewer jobs.
Mr. President, it's all about the freedom. We fight for our freedom, we fight for our independence, we fight for our sovereignty, and we will never surrender.
Hostile questions about health care reform by actor Zach Galifianakis were just a joke as President Obama last week sought more participation by young Americans on the internet comedy show Between Two Ferns. But the critique of Fox Cable Stuart Varney was real enough and reflective of most conservative opinion after the president signed legislation to expand the ranks of workers who must be paid overtime. And the Ukraine's new president, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, underscored his plea for strong presidential support in the face of a questionable referendum in Crimea this weekend that could make it Russian again. And those were only three of important dynamics dominating Washington last week.
Escalating pressure from Hispanic groups and their sympathizers in the Senate forced Obama to promise consideration of more humane immigration enforcement as deportations reached a record 2 million. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein, meanwhile, escalated her charge that the CIA had taken computer files from a committee staff investigation of spy agency interrogation excesses. She and other Senate women also were divided over the failure to pass new legislation to remove military commanders from decisions on prosecuting the ever-growing problem of sexual assaults up and down the ranks. And policy aside, dismayed Democrats were analyzing their loss in a closely watched Florida congressional race. To consider all this and more for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a contributor at thedailybeast.com. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
What lessons about issues and tactics do you draw from that Florida loss?
Well, the Democrats have been saying that if they don't turn out the Obama coalition in these off-year elections without Obama on the ticket, they're going to lose, and they fulfill that prediction. The Democrats did not get the turnout that they hoped for, and basically they have underscored the problem that they face in energizing voters to come out when the president is not on the ticket and when voters aren't even all that excited about the president.
Obamacare was a key issue. The administration claims there are now enough participants for the program to succeed, but no promises there won't be more delays in key mandates. Would that do more to ease public opposition to the program or give Republicans more ammunition to condemn it?
Well, I think the Republicans are going to take anything the administration does and use it to undermine the program. Frankly, these are the kind of adjustments that you would make in any big social program, and this is a program that is remaking how many Americans receive health care, or if they receive health care at all. Normally, in normal times, you would have Congress coming together, policy people, and they'd make what I think really are what we call tweaks. But these aren't normal times. And so I think the next several months are perilous, and especially leading into the 2014 election.
On de-escalating deportations, some Latino leaders are boasting about Obama's promise, while others fear it's more rhetorical than real. Why does the president claim to be more constrained by immigration law now than when he found a way around it for the so-called Dreamer generation that were brought here illegally as children? What real action do you expect?
Well, I think, again, I use the word tweak. I mean, I think they can look at some of these cases and be a little more selective about who they prosecute and who they deport. And I think with the Dreamers, I think the president made a wise decision that kids brought here through no fault of their own illegally and who are doing well in this country should have a chance to stay. And that's not an open-ended chance. I mean, I think there's a time limit on that change in the law that he made. And now he's got a different motivation. He's going into a difficult election. Hispanics are a key ally for Democrats, and they're furious over this deportation. And I think the president thought if he was, you know, tough in this area, that it might smooth the way to get some legislation out of Congress. That's clearly not going to happen. So I think he's decided he's got to take his foot off the gas on these deportations, which they can do, I think, with, you know, minor adjustments in the law. So there are political motivations behind what he's doing, clearly.
You've said the real winner in the effort to reform sex abuse prosecution in the military is the senator who lost the vote. Explain that.
The battle was between two key Democratic female senators, Claire McCaskill of Missouri and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. McCaskill won the fight, and she did push through legislation that made a number of key changes in how sexual crimes are prosecuted in the military. But all the attention was on McCaskill's more far-reaching attempt to take these prosecutions out of the chain of command. And so
Wait, it was Gillibrand who took it out of who wanted
Gillibrand, right.
Right.
And basically, Gillibrand emerges as a hero. People who have felt that they've been wronged under the current system, you know, have lobbied Capitol Hill, and she's gotten a lot of attention. And so she, you know, emerges as the champion of the people who lost the battle. And the battle is not over, because unless the military does quickly change its way, this issue will be back before the Congress again.
You've written recently about the Ukraine confrontation as analyzed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. How tough does she think Washington can be without triggering a military confrontation, a Moscow shutoff of energy to Europe, or an outcry from U.S. companies doing business in Russia?
Well, I think Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, who was born in Europe, you know, understands the problems here, you know, better than anyone else. And I think she's very comfortable with the Europeans taking a lead. And Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, has suddenly sounded a lot tougher herself in recent days, trying to get the message across to the Russian president, Mr. Putin, that we live in an interconnected world economically, and that the Europeans have some cards to play, and maybe they're not going to just, you know, roll over this time, because they don't want to run into problems with him over their oil and gas supply. So I think it's a confrontation that's going on more in Europe and over what the European Union will do than it has to do with President Obama. I think he's on the sidelines here, which is a place he seems more comfortable being, frankly, and that doesn't always bode well for his leadership in this country.
Thanks, Eleanor. Veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a regular contributor at thedailybeast.com.
Quote from the news, "The very worst job I have ever had." That was David Wright on his resignation as director of the Health and Human Services Department's Office of Research Integrity that investigates misconduct in federally funded scientific research. He blamed micromanagement by bureaucrats with little understanding of the problem.
Next, the first year of Francis and what may come next for Your Ears Only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with this quote from the news. The election is going to be a farce. They will fix everything for him. That was former Egyptian general and prime minister Ahmed Shafik on why he decided against running in the upcoming election for president, which most assume will be won by the current military leader, Field Marshal Abdul Fattah el-Sisi. Also last week, the UN Syria mediator Lakhdar Brahimi said impending elections under discussion there might fatally jeopardize negotiations for a transitional government. Now this.
You know
that
the duty of the conclave was that of giving a bishop to Rome. It appears that my brothers, the cardinals, went to get it all over to the end of the world.
And now,
I would like to bless
prima,
you.
Vi chiedo un favore.
But first
prima
of all,
che il vescovo benedica
I ask
il popolo,
you for a favor. Before that the bishop blesses the people,
pregate al Signore perché mi benedica la preghiera del popolo chiedendo la benedizione per il suo vescovo.
The Lord to bless the bishop.
That was the opening to our segment on naming the new pope a year ago this week. Francis' first words made it clear he would be a historically progressive, populist, and popular pontiff. But actual changes in the body and spirit of the church that Francis has made in the years since are still a surprise to many.
To review those changes and the directions in which Francis is leading his global flock on this anniversary weekend, for your ears only, we're joined by Kenneth L. Woodward, longtime religion editor of Newsweek magazine in its golden era. He's also author of The Book of Miracles, The Meaning of the Miracle Stories in Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam, and Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a saint, who doesn't, and why. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
The cardinals who named him pope, and soon afterwards the world, clearly understood Francis's concern for the poor in his humble ways, riding the subway back in Argentina, for example. What was the biggest surprise for you in his words and actions since?
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with you. I don't think the cardinals that elected him knew all that that much about his background. They liked what he said in a little five-minute talk that he gave, all the cardinals did, saying that the church should be concerned with the world and not navel-gazing. And they knew that whoever was elected was going to have a mandate for reforming the church. But the gesture that really captured me, and I've been waiting years for a pope to do this, was when he said, I don't want to live in the apostolic palace. I want to live where other people are. The idea that he wanted to be with other people tells me, or only emphasizes, that this guy is not a lone ranger. He is making the changes by incorporating other people with him. He's got a team of eight cardinals working with him, for example. So it's a collaborative effort. And the other thing it tells me about him is his openness. He, unlike John Paul II especially, liked to hear people disagree with him and likes to hear discussion, and then he makes up his mind.
Polls show that Catholics and non-Catholics alike have a better feeling about the church under Francis, but no significant increase in confessions or just regular attendance at Mass, at least not yet. Can that be seen as a failure at this early point?
David, I don't think so. Look, confessions began to fall off right after Vatican Council II. We're talking about the end of the 1960s. Subsequent generations of Catholics just never got the habit of confessing their sins or even seeing themselves as sinners.
Well, there have been some substantive changes, for example, on church finances, which were often mysterious or downright questionable. Talk about that and other systemic changes that you see as important that he has already started.
Well, as I said, when they collected a year ago the cardinals to elect a new pope, they had a dossier from Benedict saying, we've got real problems, scandals to some extent. We have cliques. We have careerism and all of this going on in the Vatican bureaucracy. And I think that that this institutional change is extraordinarily important, and he has he has been working on it from the beginning. You're already beginning to see some changes. He has changed things in the Vatican Bank. He's got a very tough guy running Vatican finances, and there'll be no money laundering and so on, which they've had in the past. So that's a real institutional change. He's changed personnel, and they are now discussing changing structure. Changing the culture is much harder to do. How do you ask somebody to come and work at the Vatican but not be a careerist? You know, there's a certain human incentive to move up. So it will be interesting to see if he can make that change.
Well, one area where there seems to be less concrete action is on the role of women in the church, which Francis has acknowledged should be greater. Do you expect much more?
Yeah, I think this is going to take considerable consideration. Many years ago, a Catholic who was anthropologist, Mary Douglas, here in Chicago, at Northwestern, made a proposal, and I think it's the kind of thing they're going to think about, which is to say that No, they're not going to ordain women. The Pope has already said that's to make them clericals, and he's against clericalism, which is the privileging of a particular class. But I think they might have a synod or body of women, international meeting, who, if you'll pardon the expression, act as a kind of placenta for legislation that it gets changes. They'll look at it and say, how is this going to affect women? That's entirely possible.
There are also complaints that the church under Francis continues to drag its feet and pat its back on dealing with child sex abuse by priests and the blind eye turned by the Catholic hierarchy. How do you see that?
I'm glad he hasn't said anything. They've instituted reforms. They've done mea culpas on top of mea culpas. So this is a 30-year-old story, which I think can be put to bed. I would like to see them say... go after bishops who weren't forthcoming on this issue and say, look, even bishops are going to be penalized. They could lose their bishop status, I guess.
Kenneth L. Woodward was the longtime religion editor at Newsweek magazine. He's also author of The Book of Miracles, The Meaning of the Miracle Stories in Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam, and Making Saints, How the Catholic Church Determines Who Becomes a Saint, Who Doesn't, and Why. In the works now is a new book, Getting Religion, about the various ways Americans have adapted, adopted, and transformed their religious attachment since the 1950s.
A quote from the news, there were some simple, perhaps sloppy mistakes that I thought were honest mistakes. That was Boston anesthesiologist Charles Vacanti after one of his co-authors called for withdrawal of papers suggesting a simple new way to create stem cells, about which we reported on this show several weeks ago.
Next, theater for the ears only, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Airbags are supposed to deploy whether people have been drinking or not. That was Rob Gritton, attorney for a family whose daughter died when the airbag in her 2005 Chevrolet Cobalt failed during a drunk driving accident. Her death was among more than 300 now thought linked to an ignition system failure that led General Motors to a long-delayed recall of 1.6 million older cars under pressure from investigators and Congress. Now this.
You know how I've been down for a while?
Down?
Yeah, I've been sad, kind of, depressed for a long time.
Huh.
Yeah, I've discussed this.
With me?
Yes, with you. Anyway, I've been reading a series of articles by this therapist who did a lot of work post 9/11.
Okay, sure.
Are you listening to me?
Every word.
Oh, because you're kind of just looking at your telephone, really.
I actually pay better attention looking at the phone than if I was looking right at you.
Really?
Yep.
If that exchange has you thinking inexplicably of your Facebook page, it may be because it's from a short comedy written by and starring Jesse Eisenberg, who played Mark Zuckerberg in the box office hit The Social Network. And Eisenberg is only one of many big names doing little plays for the nonprofit group Playing On Air to bring appreciation of theater to radio and internet listeners.
The brainchild of former actress and producer Claudia Catania launched 2 years ago. Playing On Air has produced 12 separate programs, each about an hour long, with about three short plays per show, and major talent like actors Eisenberg, Jerry Stiller, and Jane Krakowski, and Pulitzer-winning playwright David Lindsay Abaire, who also wrote the movies Poltergeist and Oz the Great and Powerful. Next week, Playing On Air kicks off a new season in Brooklyn with its first recording before a live audience, starring Bobby Cannavale, John Leguizamo, and Rosie Perez. But for your ears only, we have a preview and a backstage history from Claudia Catania herself. Welcome to our production.
Thank you.
Tell us about yourself, your earlier work in theater and other fields.
Well, I started as an actress, I guess as a lot of us do, and met a playwright and suddenly found myself editing his plays and others, and that took me to publishing theater and for a small imprint called Applause, and that took me to producing short play festivals of pieces we published, and then I found myself, as a result of that, working for a not-for-profit off-Broadway theater company and producing commercially, and now this.
Theatrical productions were a staple of early radio, including the 1938 Orson Welles War of the Worlds production that nearly caused a national heart attack. What prompted you to bring theater back to the air?
Theater and radio, I think, is a match made in heaven because the plays really profit when they're spiked with the listener's imagination. And in today's world, people live busy, on-the-go lives, and sitting down to a full-length play with undivided attention for 2 hours is sometimes a tall order. So short plays on radio seem to make good sense. But The main reason, I think, to bring radio back to the air is it's a perfect way to reach more people, to extend theater stage. Not everybody lives near a professional theater, and not everyone can shell out big bucks, at least on a habitual basis. So this is a way to bring a taste of a major art form to many people, regardless of their location or their time constraints or their budget.
Are the plays specially written or rewritten to be heard and not seen?
That is a good question. The concept behind playing on air is that a taste of theater on radio is a good thing. And so as a result, we really wanted to present stage plays. And what we essentially do is find stage plays that translate well to the radio. That is, they're not highly physical, they're not highly visual, they're not full of language that would drive the FCC crazy and leave us with more bleeps than words. So if we think that we have a play that will work on radio well for those reasons, it might be just fine as is, or we'll ask a playwright to add a couple of words to compensate for a missing visual like, oh my God, you have a gun, that kind of thing, or to replace a no-no word with another one. And thus far, playwrights have been happy to make those minuscule adjustments, and sometimes as a result, they're even better or funnier than the original.
Do you have much trouble getting them? Do you pay them, or are they doing this pro bono, you know, for the mission that you've outlined?
Well, they're being paid so modestly that it's virtually pro bono. but everyone does get paid. The unions have been very encouraging because they obviously want actors to work and to spread theater. Yeah, they do get paid, and they've also been really generous with their time, because from their vantage point, they're obviously being paid peanuts.
How many public radio stations carry your productions, and with how big an audience?
I would say we are on around 43 by now, which together maybe serve 2.5 million people, which is, you know, from a theater vantage point, fantastic. Lots of New York City theater houses have 99 seats in them. So to be able to grow an audience for theater like this is really exciting.
Why the move to a live audience for the two shows you'll record on March 24th and 31st? And will they be staged readings, in other words, actors with scripts in their hands, or are they really memorizing their lines like in real theater?
Well, why live? It's an experiment for sure. If we're in the studio, it allows for all kinds of many takes and lots of editing, so we might get a more polished, finished product. But an audience could lend a more exciting experience, so time will tell. It happened because one of our playwrights, David Ives, basically said, Claudia, you know, you're never going to raise money without raising your profile, and we should do this in front of the public. Call a meeting. So I did, since David Ives is one of the smartest men alive. And about six of us met in my apartment, including Lynn Nottage, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner for Ruined, and Jesse Eisenberg, who's a great playwright, incidentally. And everyone agreed that this was a great idea, and Lynn suggested Brick, and David made martinis, and that was it. So we're going to give it a go.
Besides being in the live audience or catching the radio broadcasts, can potential listeners find an archive of current and past productions online?
Yes. They certainly can. They can go to our website, which is playingonair.org, and they can stream about at least five or six episodes. They can also listen to them on iTunes and, of course, the radio. And hopefully we'll also have a place where they store quite soon where they could also, for a very minimal fee, 99 cents or something, buy the older episodes. But we always have at least six up for free, which is, you know, 20 plays.
Claudia Catania is producer and host of Playing on Air, which will be recording its next broadcast in front of live audiences on March 24th and 31st at the Brick House in downtown Brooklyn. Details at playingonair.org.
Quote from the news, it ripped the stomach right out of you. That was Malcolm McMahon after the gas explosion two blocks away that killed at least eight and left more than 50 injured in an East Harlem, New York neighborhood.
Next, The Grandson also rises on the music of Jobim for Your Ears Only. A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with this quote from the news. There does come a time to pass the torch of leadership. That was Arizona Governor Jan Brewer on deciding not to find a way around the state's two-term limit following years of controversy over her stance against immigration, abortion, and, more surprisingly, against a proposed bill to give business owners the right to refuse service to homosexual couples and others who offended their religious principles. Now this.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's the rest of a stump, it's a little alone. It's a sliver of glass, it is life, it's the sun. It is night, it is death. It's a trap, it's a gun. The oak when it burns.
For Brazilian pianist, singer, songwriter Daniel Jobim, that song called The Waters of March is not only magical music, but a family tradition and a legacy. It was written by his famous grandfather, Antonio Carlos Jobim, whose bossa nova style and spirit he helps keep alive in his native land and around the world.
This week, he joins American guitar virtuoso John Pizzarelli for a two-week run featuring both Jobim classics and bossa nova versions of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley standards by Rodgers, Hart, the Gershwins, and such.
And to talk more about the show, his grandfather's music, and his own, for your ears only, Daniel Jobim is on the line from Rio now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, David.
You're old enough to have known and even worked with your grandfather, who came to symbolize Brazilian music. You made music with your father as well, but I read somewhere that he was also an architect, suggesting that at some point he might have wanted to move away from the family's focus on music. Is that true, and did you ever feel that way, or was music always your calling?
Well, music was always my calling, but it's funny because my father and my grandfather also, he studied architecture too, so they both studied architecture before following on music, but they always had music in their lives, and music took over.
Being a Jobim grandson must have made for great professional connections, but also pretty high expectations. Was that a burden on you?
Well, not too much, because I love his music so much, and I've been listening to his music since I was very little, and he used to play piano every morning, and I would wake up to his music, and it's natural for me. It's not like a burden or something that I'm forced to do. It's something very easy, and I love doing it.
Talk about some of the other great musicians you've played with, and where around the world.
Oh, my God. You know, I played one time with João Gilberto. It was unbelievable, one or two times. And he's such a genius and difficult to play with different people. He plays alone always, so it was great to play with him. And I've played with, Michael Cimbello and Stevie Wonder and Caetano Veloso, Chico Buarque, Milton Nascimento. We did a big tour around the world. And Lee Ritenour, Dave Grusin, everybody.
Here in America, the great old standard songs endure, but they're clearly overshadowed by rock, rap, and other pop since the Beatles. Does bossa nova have competition like that in Brazil?
Bossa nova, I think, always will have its own space, will never die, because such a rich music and mixes with so many styles, with jazz, and people can improvise. And so I think bossa nova will always be there besides everything else. So, of course, there's carnival music, there's samba, there's songs from Bahia, but it doesn't matter. Bossa nova is strong.
And where do you see the music you create fitting into the mix?
You know, I play bossa nova, naturally. Acoustic piano, acoustic guitar, the band is always acoustic. Sometimes, like, after playing with Pizzarelli, I'm going to Japan with Lee Ritenour and Dave Grusin. So we're going to have two pianos on stage, but we will also have some synthesizers. But that's not every day. So it's just, usually it's all acoustic. That's what I do.
What are some of the Jobim classics you'll be performing with guitarist John Pizzarelli at the Carlisle?
Oh, we'll play, of course, The Girl from Ipanema, Gingy, So Danço Samba, One Note Samba, and Waters of March, of course. Água de Bebê, Desafinado, Corcovado. Yeah, many, many of his good songs.
And what are some of the American standards you'll be doing, and who created the bossa nova renditions? You or Pizzarelli or both of you, in person or long distance?
Yeah, we did together because we did a big tour in 2004. Only playing bossa nova, so this time we're going to do fascinating rhythm, but that's an arrangement that my grandfather did on his album Passarim for Verve Records, I think in 87. So we do, based on his bossa nova version of Fascinating Rhythm, but we play it in our own way. And some other songs he does, My Valentine and Estate, which João Gilberto, it's an Italian song that João Gilberto recorded on his album Amoroso, and we do it too. So, you know, we always blend the show when I play with Pizzarelli with American standards because it's great, and that's what Sinatra did with my grandfather too. They would do a few bossa nova songs and a few American classics in the bossa nova, with the bossa nova rhythm, right?
And do you have a favorite among the great American songwriters?
Oh, the songwriters. I love Gershwin, Cole Porter, and even, you know, the newest. I'm a big fan of Michael Jackson. Big fan. I love Michael Jackson.
Brazilian pianist, singer-songwriter Daniel Jobim joins American guitarist John Pizzarelli to celebrate the music of Antonio Carlos Jobim and classic American songs in bossa nova style, March 18th through the 29th at New York's Café Carlyle, 35 East 76th Street on Madison Avenue, and www.thecarlyle.com. Follow Jobim on Facebook or Twitter at Daniel_Jobim.
Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet nights of quiet stars.
Daniel Jobim and his grandfather's Corcovado. And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, Feedburner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Sarah Skirmont and Jean Moon. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week last year, we considered growing hostility between the leaders of Afghanistan and international forces fighting for them, especially from the United States, from our March 17, 2013 broadcast hosted by David and Eddie Robinson.
The foreigners, NATO, the Americans, have all come with the permission of the UN Security Council's mandate. They've started this war, but they didn't start it in the right place. They should be in the terrorists' bases. The bombs that exploded in Kabul and Khost didn't show the Taliban's power to the Americans. They were doing a service for America.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has always been a maddening, maybe medicated political personality. But his anti-American rhetoric reached new heights last week, accusing the United States of collaborating with Taliban terror attacks to create support for continuing U.S. military presence and influence. The American commander in Afghanistan, General Joseph Dunford Jr., responded with orders for stepped-up security against what he saw as an increased risk to Western troops from militants and Afghan security forces themselves.
As the scheduled pullout of U.S. forces continues, the Afghan society, psychology, and politics that Karzai attempts to orchestrate will become at least as important as the military balance that remains. This is an area of special interest to Susan Frachel, a journalist, novelist, and analyst for Yale Global Online. Her latest book on the hardships of Muslim women is Fear of Beauty, from 7th Street Prometheus Publishers. And for Your Ears Only, Susan Frachel is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Whatever Karzai's mental condition, we have to admit that America has proved a fair-weather friend in the past, turning away after reversal of the Soviet occupation, paving the way for al-Qaeda, in fact.
Yes, that's true, and the United States is withdrawing again. But NATO and the United States have done a lot of work there that's been appreciated, especially the work from the provincial reconstruction teams, you know, trying to introduce new techniques of agriculture, provide technical assistance, health clinics, education facilities. And Afghans have seen an alternative, you know, future. And it's up to them to decide if they want to continue in those directions. And this is the outcome that will be looked for by the international community and NGOs and diplomats around the world.
Let's get some facts on the table. How large is the Taliban force in Afghanistan today versus the number of Afghan security forces that we've built up before we leave?
The last good estimate I read was reported by Reuters in February 2012, and they estimated the number of Taliban fighters at 25,000 at most, and that's in a country of 30 million people. And previous reports have always said that the vast majority of them are in it for economic reasons. It's a job. They're not really the hardcore jihadist types. So about the Afghan National Army, they've achieved the recruitment goal of 195,000 troops. And the National Police has 149,000. And there's others. You know, there's, you know, several thousand Air Force. There's special ops. And the police and security have about 25,000, so it's a total of more than 350,000. The force should be on the official Afghan side.
Even if the Taliban can't retake control of the national government, can you imagine them asserting control in specific areas, either through military means or the kind of political settlement that many Western experts support?
There's the problems of geography. There's uneven infrastructure. You know, some communities are very isolated. You know, the biggest challenge is the low literacy rates and high fragmentation. And, yes, all that means that some communities are going to succumb to the pressures. Fundamentalists, you know, in Islam, they're throughout the world, and they're trying to get power, and they're not going to give up.
What happens in those areas to the progress of women in terms of education and rights?
They're going to be marginalized. They'll be pushed out of the schools, and free thought and dissent won't be allowed among any, you know, in the populace, men or women alike. The low literacy rates will persist, and the people who can leave will try and get away from those communities. This has happened in the past with the, you know, big waves of Afghans. Hopefully, the Afghans will realize that alternatives do exist. Hopefully, they can resist and convince entire communities to resist.
To what degree do you see the new technology affecting the Afghan future? It makes people more aware of other ways of life, as you suggested, could provide at-home education for women, maybe set the stage for organizing a new politics, though that hasn't proved a panacea in the Arab Spring generally.
That is one of the hopeful signs. There are huge opportunities that were not available in the mid-1990s when the Taliban took control. You know, we see the power of globalization in communications time and time again, as one photo or one video is posted online by an individual and it quickly rallies global support. And then the other thing is there is also amazing new ways, to analyze large sets of data, and the military has been doing this, you know, for example, with GIS mapping software. And they use this software, you know, they look at data from, at the province level or even at the local community level, and, you know, you can put this data on the map and instantly see where, like, there might be different correlations between, say, water availability and public health. And this allows analysts and government officials to immediately know better than ever before how to target certain areas for enforcement or for, you know, security and that sort of thing. And probably the best thing about, you know, new technology is that the days of doublespeak are over, that, you know, any politician can take one position, you know, today in front of an audience, and then tomorrow he takes the opposite position in front of a different audience. those days are over. Politicians around the world are discovering this, and so too will the politicians in Afghanistan.
Susan Fraichel is a journalist, novelist, and analyst for Yale Global Online. Her latest book on the hardships of Muslim women is Fear of Beauty, from 7th Street Prometheus Publishers.
Afghanistan, Hostile Allies. From a March 17, 2013 broadcast, at least 16 U.S. soldiers were killed by Afghan trainees and other security forces last year. And by last week, the number of all Americans who have died there since 2001 reached 2,176. Intense negotiation did produce a status of forces agreement to permit some U.S. troops to remain after 2014, but President Karzai has steadfastly refused to sign it prior to the pending national election to replace him. In Senate testimony last week, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General Joseph Dunford Jr., said that if Karzai's successor signs the agreement by August, there will be sufficient time to make effective arrangements for a major withdrawal and a residual international force. After that point, he predicted the risk to an orderly withdrawal begins to get high. And without a residual military presence, Dunford warned, Al-Qaeda would regroup and stage another attack on the West. Staying for such a mission, said West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin, makes no sense at all. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Daniel Jobim again with All of Corcovado by Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Me star.